So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, and joining me from New York is Rafat Ali. How are you doing, Rafat?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's been kind of a busy time lately with, I guess, the Facebook IPO and its complete faceplant, which is now leading to lawsuits and Morgan Stanley under the spotlight and everything else. I mean, that just seemed like a complete disaster.
Yeah, and the story that Henry Blodgett wrote,
kind of his inside story.
Inside story was just incredible. I mean, I don't understand I don't understand mechanics of it. It was the backstory is fascinating because Reuters and Bloomberg reporters had that 10 days ago. And as part of their or a few days ago, whatever it was, as part of their stories, but they didn't connect the dots. And Henry saw it like four paragraphs in a Reuters story, and like he did a double take. He said, "What?" And then, really, is that what? And then, of course, he being there, he is the reason why a lot of these rules exist, right? I mean, he understands the stuff. So. And so he, of course, connected the dots. That's the difference between somebody like an industry insider who knows such arcane stuff and the journalists who barely sort of understand it.
And the basic idea is that that Morgan Stanley was giving this kind of information out to only specific investors and not giving it out to the kind of the general public like they should.
The general public, yeah. And this comes up with, I mean, it's come up in the last 2 years, 2-3 years, every digital media or internet related IPO, really the retail investor like you and me or whoever will end up buying some of the stock are suckers and the people, the company and the bankers. But that, I guess, has always been there. It's just that in this age of Facebook, Twitter and all the media scrutiny, it just becomes a lot more apparent, especially post-2008.
And I mean, this goes beyond just kind of the average investor getting screwed. I mean, this is a lot of people. I mean, it seems like even the institutional investors who got in and bought early, I mean, even they're hit when the stock takes a drop the first few days like it has.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not – I probably can't comment beyond that. But yes, it just seems like I mean, fundamentally, people, I think you and I, being in the industry, follow Facebook, don't think Facebook is going away anytime soon. And I think it'd be just, can they focus now with all this stuff going around them?
Right. And all the lawsuits, too, that are coming against them. I mean, that's something you'll have to deal with. Yeah. The other story that we're kind of following is that the Times-Picayune, the daily paper in New Orleans, now announced that it's going to be coming out less than daily, that it'll be just three times a week. And then we also had a story today in Media Shift from the Oregon Daily Emerald, which is the paper of the University of Oregon. They've also decided not to be a daily paper, to go to twice a week and become more of an alt-weekly. And I think in both cases, they're going to focus a lot more on online, digital, mobile platforms. I mean, that seems like it's going to happen more and more. I mean, is this kind of rather than the end of print, it seems like it's just coming out a lot less often now.
I think this is a very natural evolution of how things are supposed to happen.
Yeah.
I would be curious to hear your thoughts on like the college media part, which just seems such a no-brainer for college newspapers to sort of ditch print or at least have a reduced print run, because college kids are the biggest consumers of digital. I mean, this is their whole life has been digital, so it just seems such a no-brainer that I'm surprised that this hasn't been done before.
Yeah, the college, the publisher who wrote the story was saying that they had seen some research on, you know, college-age people in the U.S. and, you know, what they were reading or their reading habits, and how, if you looked at it, I think the percentage that were reading print papers on a daily basis went down. I think it got down to 7% in the most recent year, and I think that was just the thing that just completely stuck out to them is, wow, like I just couldn't believe how low readership got in their age range. So yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense for students to start thinking about it. And I think the interesting thing that they're doing is, you know, they're trying to do more than just, okay, we're gonna have a website, that's where we're gonna put our efforts. I mean, they're also saying they're gonna do you know, kind of ad services for the community and, you know, be more kind of an ad agency. I mean, they're doing a lot that I think is kind of interesting and beyond just the journalism part of it.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, it's happening on a large media company scale where they're moving into marketing services, companies like Hearst and Meredith and others, and college media companies that are in those markets understand the local market better than anything else. How do you monetize it beyond sort of the content part of it?
Okay. Well, on this show, let's talk. We'll talk about. We'll definitely come back to that and think more about what's going on with newspapers and just kind of what's happening with print. But on this show, we'll also talk about Craig Newmark, who founded Craigslist, is connecting with Poynter on an ethics symposium that they're going to put together and try to look at new guiding principles for journalists in the digital age. And we'll have Craig Newmark as well as Kelly McBride for Poynter on. And then we'll have the author of The Crowdfunding Bible, Scott Steinberg, a book that was just released recently that looks at the way that companies can raise money with crowdfunding, a totally new way of kind of funding themselves. So Craigslist founder Craig Newmark's Craig Connects is teaming up with the Poynter Institute to host an ethics symposium in New York this fall. The symposium will lead to the creation of a new set of guiding principles for journalists and other content creators concerned with democratic standards of truth in the digital age. Poynter President Karen Dunlap said, "With the dramatic changes in journalism, it's time for a new set of standards to reflect the new values of the world in which we live and consume news." Our guests are Craig Newmark and Kelly McBride. Craig Newmark's a self-described nerd, pioneer of the web, speaker, philanthropist, and strong advocate of the use of technology for public good. He founded Craigslist in 1995, and it's become one of the world's most visited websites. In 2011, he founded Craig Connects, a personal web-based initiative to stand up for organizations getting stuff done in areas that he's passionate about. Welcome, Craig.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
And Kelly McBride is a writer, teacher, and one of the country's leading voices when it comes to media ethics. She's been on the faculty at the Poynter Institute for 8 years. Her current work involves Poynter's Sense-Making Project, a Ford Foundation project examining the transformation of journalism from a profession of a few to a civic obligation of many, the effects of technology on democracy, and the media habits of the millennial generation. Welcome to the show, Kelly.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So, Craig, let's start with you. What made you decide to do this symposium? What was it that, drew you to this and this project and just the idea of kind of looking at ethics?
Basically, I'm a consumer of news. I just want news that I can trust again, because, like I like to say, the press is the immune system of democracy. And I'm not in the business, though. Not going to tell people how to do their job, but everyone in the business tells me that the way to restore trust in journalism involves things like better fact-checking specifically and better ethics in general.
And so your goal in getting involved in this is basically to help support what Poynter was already doing.
Yeah, as it turns out, Poynter has already been a pretty big deal in the area of journalistic ethics. I take a look at what's already been done, and I'm pretty impressed. Oh, some ethical statements maybe need to be revised for the new news environment because there's a lot of jobs involved, and the pressures are intense. But people got to do the right thing, whatever the right thing turns out to be.
So Kelly, tell us a little bit more about this sense-making project. You had some Ford funding from it. What were the goals behind this project? What were you trying to make sense of?
Well, we're really trying to figure out how democracy functions as the world of journalism changes. It's very clear that the professional world of journalism, the fourth estate, is going to get smaller and smaller. It won't completely disappear, but the number of people working as journalists will continue to decline because of economic forces. In that vacuum, there's a group that we call the fifth estate, which are sort of hybrid journalists. They're people who are freelancers, they're citizens, they're very interested in journalism, but they're not being paid to primarily do journalism. Some of them are bloggers, and they are filling in the gaps left behind by the Fourth Estate. And because of that, a lot of the standards in journalism are changing. The standards of how we fact check information, the standards of how we disseminate information, the standards of when we correct information. So we really wanted to look at how all of these changes affect our ability as a society to function, specifically as a democracy, and we wanted to influence all of the people in this process with the hopes of strengthening democracy.
So here's an example that just came up recently. Eric Jackson, a guy who's been a guest on our show, who writes on Forbes, wrote this story about, it kind of came across as a sexist story that he posted, and he kind of retracted the story and put an apology in its place, and a lot of people were upset that the original story just disappeared. Then it kind of came back, but it was an edited version. So, I mean, is that the kind of thing that you're looking at and saying, like, how do you deal with something that's pulled down and changed and corrected online? Because I know there's been a lot of talk about what to do with that.
Oh, yeah, precisely. That's a great example. Because in the past, you couldn't just take information away. You couldn't just take it out of the marketplace of ideas. Because once you'd published it, it was there. But now you can. If something's been published digitally and you decide that you don't want it out there anymore, you can try and take it down. And that has an impact on how we have conversations. So the audience can influence your work and can attack you. And sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. And how organizations make a decision about what to correct, when to take something down, when to apologize, when something was bad. That's one small piece of this great big transformation that we're going through. That 5 years ago we would not have had that conversation.
So this is Rafa. My question, I guess, to either of you, Kelly or Craig, is so the symposium seems to be sort of timely. What, beyond the symposium, what are the sort of actionable steps you think that potentially could be adopted? Is the hope that their set of guidelines or something adopted industry-wide, or is it, the parallels that I'm looking at is there's a curation, ethics of curation debate, and there are a couple of companies or nonprofit projects come up with guidelines and buttons and logos and stuff in it. What's the equivalent here?
Well, so 25 years ago, the Poynter Institute created the Guiding Principles for Journalists. And the reality of the profession of journalism is you can't make a group of journalists do anything. They're not a licensed profession. But it was such a good document that it became the foundation for most professional newsrooms and professional organizations as they created their principles. I think a similar thing can happen again. And who adopts it and how much of it they adopt, well, that will be up to each individual organization. But I believe that we can create a relevant, useful set of guiding principles that address the pressures that we're feeling in this digital era. And my sense after doing this work for a couple of years is that in addition to the professional media, many, many bloggers and startups and nonprofits and in other organizations that I would consider more Fifth Estate than Fourth Estate will willingly embrace this set of principles.
Yeah. For me, I'd like to see the press help make democracy work better. For example, it would be good if ethical standards were reasserted such that material wouldn't be misrepresented, material wouldn't be fabricated, news outlets would be open and honest about advertising. For example, there's a new FCC rule about TV stations disclosing sources of political advertising, and yet the NAB is fighting that. I'd like the TV stations to be honest about it. And for that matter, I don't know if they should run ads which they know are deceptive.
So what, now you're going to have the symposium. Tell us a little bit of how it'll work. You have 16 people that are coming to present papers. There'll be obviously some discussion. What kind of things do you think will come out of it?
Well, first of all, so we haven't decided on who the 16 authors are, but we're working on a short list now. But our goal is to get a diverse group of voices, both traditional media and some newer voices into the mix. Each of them will take a couple of case studies that have something to do with each other. It might be the conflict between making money and telling the truth, or it might be something about fact-checking, it might be something about aggregation, but each of them will take a case study and write a fairly lengthy, robust essay on that case study, and it will be in draft form by the time we get to the symposium. We'll gather. We will spend 2 days discussing these ideas that each of these authors have come up with and boiling it down into a set of principles. This will give the authors the opportunity to test out their ideas, perhaps to refine them a little bit. We'll create the document, the what I think it will fit on one page. And we'll talk about how people apply that document, how newsrooms apply that document. And then afterwards, the authors will refine their essays into final versions. And those will be published in a collection, in a book by CQ Press. And that book is meant for both the classroom, the newsroom, and the general audience. So we're hoping that this should have some legs. It's not just something that will end after the symposium is over.
How do you, which all sounds very noble, but how do you sort of make ethics a part of, I don't know, journalism school curriculum that is right now focused on, I don't know, the teaching the next greatest online mobile tool these days, and ethics has taken to in a lot of schools has taken a backseat.
Oh, in journalism schools, it's actually easier than it is with the general industry because journalism school curriculums are certified by AEJMC, American Education Journalism Mass Communication. I think that's what that stands for. But they certify schools, and they have as one of, I believe, their five tenets of certification, a requirement that a robust ethics curriculum be present. And we work, we at Poynter work with AEJMC a lot. So it's actually easier to get into the academy than it is to get into newsrooms. Newsrooms, you tend to get into newsrooms when they desperately need you, which means that they've either already screwed up or they've been screwing up or they're about to screw up. And so that involves training. And I think that will be the next step is once we get this set of principles, then I think we'll look at how do we reach out to newsrooms, both old and new, to help them figure out how to apply these standards.
Yeah, especially it seems like the newer ones will be hard to reach. I mean, the older ones, I would think they know what Poynter does, but the newer ones always seem to have kind of disdain in a way for some of the old ways of doing things.
I think that's why the voices that we have participating in this process are really important because they have to have credibility with this newer audience.
Yeah. From my point of view, being an outsider, I can observe that there's a tremendous hunger to get news, well, to buy news that is actually presented in an ethical manner, abandoning things like the view from nowhere and so on. That gives students trained to do things like fact-checking and so on a competitive edge. I would pay for news, again, presented honestly in that manner. I really don't want to pay for news that I can't trust.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, thanks, guys, for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
My pleasure.
So the Crowdfunding Bible by Scott Steinberg was just released last Thursday. It's a complete how-to guide to successfully launch and market any project or startup using crowdfunding sites such as Kickstarter. The book is geared towards people who are doing a startup or if they're entrepreneurs, and it's 100% free to download online. Or you can get an Amazon Kindle edition for $2.99 or print version for $13.99. It includes expert hints and tips from today's top crowdfunding campaigns. Joining us is the author, Scott Steinberg, professional keynote speaker and leading expert on leveraging new technology trends to enhance business strategy and family life. His latest book, The Crowdfunding Bible, is free to download at crowdfundingguides.com. Welcome to our show.
Hey, Mark. How you doing?
Good. So first tell us tell us more about TechSavvy and your group. What exactly do you guys do, and what kind of speaking do you do with them?
Sure. So we're a boutique business consulting and product testing firm. We do quite a bit of market research. They're looking to bring new products or services to market. They often ask us for help for go-to-market strategies. And as far as the professional speaking practice goes, happen to be a best-selling high-tech parenting author with the Modern Parents Guide series, and also have a number of business books like the Crowdfunding Bible out there. So we're often hired to speak at corporate meetings, private events, or consumer-facing events, trade shows, and conferences, and to help people understand a little bit about how they can leverage technology to boost their business strategy or enhance their family life. So we oftentimes will speak on topics everything from social media to new technology trends to how can I improve ROI or enhance leadership in the digital age. So beats real work, as we say over here.
For sure. So what is it about crowdfunding? I mean, we hear all these stories about startups or books or movies or all these things that basically have gotten funded from the crowd. Basically, you know, someone posts their project. They say, hey, I'd love to do a book on this, or I'd love to do a movie, or I'd love to do this tech project or startup. And, you know, they have a certain amount of time, at least on Kickstarter. They've got to raise the amount that they look for. And we hear all these great stories about it. What is it about crowdfunding that just has blossomed, and why has it become such a big deal lately?
Well, it's the ultimate Cinderella story, right? So essentially what you see are these rags to riches tales. Once upon a time, if you wanted to raise money, you'd have to put together a very convoluted, complex business plan, have all sorts of fancy pitches, and then you would take them out and go to venture capitalists or angel investors and hope that they agreed with your vision. And so this small group of influential and wealthy tastemakers would oftentimes decide what the masses wanted, and that wouldn't necessarily align with reality. Now what's happening with Kickstarter, Indiegogo, Rocket Hub, other sites, is essentially with crowdfunding, you flip the model on its head, and you have creators themselves going out there, oftentimes with nothing more than concept art or a 3-minute video pitch, and saying, hey, I want to raise money, my project matters, here's why we're the right people to do it. And you actually have people donating, not expecting anything in return except for some merchandise or once-in-a-lifetime experiences, and it's allowing these creators and entrepreneurs to build great ideas right from the ground up, give up no control, actually be able to gauge just how much of a market is for them, and people actually vote with their wallets. So suddenly the masses are deciding for themselves, and brave new world of business investment.
So Rafa, you're doing a startup now. Did you ever consider doing this by kind of crowdfunding and going that route?
No, because, well, I legally I can't because it, what the contract, at least in Kickstarter is that you have to actually produce some sort of thing that you have to give back. They're not investing, they're not owning equity in your company, you have to give them a service. So, that I believe, and Scott can tell more on this, the rules are changing on it, and hopefully at some point that will be the case, but, I have not considered that. I am not on what you would call the consumer, the startup equivalent, like AngelList and stuff. I'm not on that either, because AngelList, typically most of the first time entrepreneurs are there. I've already done it once. I am actually only pitching to people that I know. So it's a different scenario, but it sort of explains why I'm not doing it.
Do you think there's a little bit of a barrier for startups that are going through something like Kickstarter, that it's a little harder for them?
Well, I don't necessarily think it's harder per se. What it is more of a consumer marketing effort than it is an actual fundraising effort, and may actually make it easier in some cases. Stories are rampant, for example, from the creator of the Pebble Watch, who talked about how VCs wouldn't even return his emails, would languish in their inbox, and suddenly you're able to go straight to the end user, to the crowd, and let them vote for themselves. So you may be able to get projects that wouldn't be seen as commercial or viable or even interesting from a major publishing house's perspective or manufacturer's perspective off the ground. But on the flip side there, of course, it's not right for every single business, and more projects are coming on board now, so the stakes are being raised in terms of consumer expectation, and it's harder than ever to get awareness for them. So discoverability is a big issue.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like if you have a startup, maybe it's not about funding a startup as much as it is an idea, a thing, a product, something that you can actually show people and get them excited about.
Yeah, and that's the big thing there, is that you're selling yourself and your creative vision as much as you are an actual end product. And many of these are not actually designed to be commercial enterprises. They're simply there to lift a project, idea, or concept off the ground. And I'll actually tell you, one of the most effective pitches recently was by Amanda Palmer, formerly of the Dresden Dolls. She was a major label expatriate. She raised money for it's a new CD, a new tour, and a new book of art. And she doesn't even speak a single word in the video, but by the end of it, you wind up falling in love with her so much in the idea of what she's trying to do. She actually holds up a sign that says, "This is the future of music," that you've bought into this idea, even though it's not necessarily what your typical investor would call a great money-making scenario.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I can say, you know, on Kickstarter at least, a lot of it has to do with that video. And if you really can, you know, connect with people in that video, you can be successful. So tell us what in doing your book and doing the research, are there specific things you can say as far as like what people should not crowdfund for?
Well, we can certainly say that if you need to raise considerable sums of capital, you don't want to go in asking for millions upon millions of dollars, right? So the more reasonable and attainable a goal seems, people are to back it. It's also not usually right for big corporate projects or things with large brands and large resources behind them. There seems to be the sense that it's a little disingenuous unless you're actually a creator who really does need the funds. Also, projects where you may have raised an equity financing round already or are not asking for enough that you need to complete them. We've actually seen now where projects will go in and say, hey, you know, we want to get about $500,000. We've already got $500,000, or we know it's not going to be enough to fund it, but we want to get it to a certain point where we think it can be successful. These aren't necessarily the best ideas to bring to crowdfunding.
Yeah. So tell us more good examples that you had from the book, because there were some really fun ones in there. What were the ones that you really enjoyed looking at or hearing from?
Well, we enjoyed, to be honest with you, looking at them all. One of the great ones was actually a project, the Giuseppe Logan project, where essentially he was a contemporary of John Coltrane who'd been found living homeless in New York. And so what they did was try and raise money for an album. Now, they brought it around to major labels and were told basically, sorry, go away, not interested, if they even got a response. And so they turned to crowdfunding. They thought, hey, you know, it's almost the equivalent of begging. It's so humiliating being the music biz as is. But when they realized they were effectively pre-selling and showing interest in the album, they embraced it and they did tremendously well with it. Other examples, of course, were excited about the Pebble Watch breakout sensation there, especially as many times as poor Eric Mijakovsky and co. got turned down. But you also get some great examples in there too from folks, the people behind, for example, the Designing Obama campaign. They wanted to create this art book around the historical presidential campaign and the artwork that was involved in it. And they encountered many foibles that creators still do today. I mean, they talk about great examples is even when you're successful, you don't necessarily think about certain things like having to pay yourself a salary or budget your own time. They've got a great aside in there about how they made these art books. They weigh pounds a pop. And the guys walking into the post office as a single person trying to figure out, how do I ship 500 to Europe? You got to contemplate some of these issues that you wouldn't necessarily think are top of mind when you're plotting a crowdfunding campaign.
So do you have any numbers as far as, let's say, even in Kickstarter or any of these services, as far as how many get funded out of how many pitches there are?
Well, I think last I saw was Kickstarter was saying something around 44% of projects fail, and that may be actually for a specific sliver or industry. You can check that. I'm sure if you Google that, you'll find it. But I think it's safe to say that the vast majority of projects are not necessarily successful or fail to reach their funding goals. It may actually be higher percentages if you look across the board at all sites. And it's important to remember that for all these success stories we hear, it's like the music business, right? You have breakout sensations, but for every one project that's succeeds, you have several dozen that quietly fade into obscurity, right?
Yeah, Yeah, and that's what I was just I was kind of curious about what how, I mean there's we do hear about all the success stories, we don't hear about all the ones that don't quite make it, but you know, it's always exciting when something breaks through, and you know, it's always kind of a feel-good story when you hear about it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why you're seeing so much attention and dollars pour into the space, and suddenly you're seeing these rags to riches tales. I mean, if you look at what Double Fine Adventure did or Wasteland 2, I mean, these were video game projects by creators who've been around since the beginning of time, who've said very bluntly, I want to make these types of games. They pitched them to publishers. They spent decades doing it. They were told these aren't commercial. They won't sell. We have no interest. And so they take it to fans themselves in what are supposedly dead genres, even in the case of the Double Fine Adventure. And then suddenly, kaboom, not only are they succeeding, but they're doing so meteorically. Suddenly, it's ignited interest in the space. And especially, I can't say I blame people, right? Because really, you're buying into this vision, this idea that you're part of a bigger movement.
It seems you're very gung-ho on the whole crowdfunding, and it seems certainly seems to have grabbed the imagination of a lot of people in the industry and of course, users as well. How are you afraid at some point that this is a curve and we're all riding it and it will sort of play out a bit like, let's say, what eBay on auctions, everybody wanted to do auctions, and like this is the next biggest thing in the world, and like group commerce came about and Groupon and all that stuff, and it sort of ridden the wave and settled somewhere below what it was when it first started. So do you think there will be a natural curve and it will the enthusiasm will go away after a while?
Yeah, I'm definitely bullish on this space, and I think we're barely scratching the surface at this point. But at the same time, I do feel that there is a little bit of a gold rush mentality going on, and we're already starting to hear rays of fatigue that's setting in because so many people are turning to crowdfunding now. The issue being discoverability and engaging communities and backers. You know, if you get 50 pitches in your inbox in the space of a week, you know, how many good ideas can you possibly do? And there's nobody there to help you space them out, right? At the same time, there is the passage of the Jobs Act, which just happened. So obviously, there are going to be limited equity investments in companies, which means that there are going to be more sites and services out there, more options, more project creators competing than ever. And at this point, we're on a meteoric growth curve. I think it's going to continue for the foreseeable future. And what may happen is you'll have interest galvanizing around certain key sites like Kickstarter or Indiegogo. But on the flip side, for mainstream consumers, that is, but on the flip side, whether it's AngelList, GrowVC, PeerBackers, whoever, you may also see community-focused sites that serve a more niche audience, whether it's filmmakers, authors, consumer electronics makers, app makers, whoever. And these may actually proliferate and do well and be able to succeed with smaller audience, tighter and more focused. But at the same time, it's hard to say just what the appetite for this is because we've never seen anything like it before. At the end of the day, right, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm an investor, but what the average person's appetite is for this type of thing, heaven only knows, right? We don't have any historical data. So inevitably, it's going to peter out at some point. You have to wonder when we're going to reach that point of oversaturation because right. It is interesting to see if the demand is going to keep up with the supply.
Definitely. Well, thanks a lot. Appreciate you joining us, Scott.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks again, Mark.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank our co-host, Rafat Ali, as well as our special guests, Craig Newmark, Kelly McBride, and Scott Steinberg, as well as PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to check out all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift. And our sister site, IdeaLab, at pbs.org/IdeaLab. And our new site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week.